have him here, a distinguished professor of Harvard University, and we're very much looking forward to his talk. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I have to admit, with a little reluctance, that I've had a wonderful 2 days. I've seen really wonderful and amazing science and engineering, and you're going to be disappointed because I have less to share with you than you've shared with me. But that said, I'm going to try and tell you about a couple of things that we've been working on in my group that involve surfaces and thin films and liquids. And the title of the talk goes something like this. There's a very brief introduction. I don't have much of an introduction. I'm going to give you a few words of a couple things and get you to try and think about the idea of a thin film of liquid, which then I'll show you a couple things about. And then there's a story in two parts. I'm going to tell you that when you pour fluid on a surface, like you do with syrup on a pancake, you expect a circular footprint of the liquid, and that's generally true, but I'll point out to you that if you spread liquid on a surface that has a pattern in it, then you can either get a circular footprint, a square footprint, or another kind of polygonal footprint, and that depends on the interplay of surface roughness and surface chemistry, and I'll tell you a little about that. And then I'll switch gears and just tell you about a different kind of thin film flow, one that involves evaporation. And basically, I'll just ask a very simple-sounding question. If you have a liquid droplet on a surface that's evaporating, there's a circulation inside. What sets the direction of the circulation? And this has been well studied in the literature by quite a number of groups. They've all arrived at the answer that the circulation is always in one direction for the most part. And I'll point out that that's because they didn't look that carefully at it, that the circulation direction can be either sign, if you like, and what you see depends on the conductivity of the substrate. And in fact, some of the things I'm going to say are very similar to what Charlie Ward and colleagues work on in mechanical engineering. Okay, so along the way, I should say, I'm going to tell you a little about surface tension. In the second part of the problem, when you have evaporation, I have to tell you something about what's called the Marangoni problem. If you drink wine and you've looked at the tears in a glass of wine in fluid mechanics, that's referred to as the Marangoni phenomena. I know Stephen Morris knows about it. How many other people know what the Marangoni phenomena is? A bunch of you. How many of you have seen a picture of Marangoni? Have you? Okay, if you have, then I have to talk after. I thought I had the only known picture of Marangoni outside of Italy. But and even inside of Italy, since they had to find it for me. Anyways, okay, so there's a little history that I'll throw in here and there. Okay, now as far as fluid mechanics go, there are two themes within kind of the physics of fluids or fluid mechanics that you'll see that are very generic and that you'll hopefully take away today, and that is in the first part of the talk, I'll just point out at one point that there's a very generic result in fluid mechanics that's very little known, and that is any time you have a viscous fluid flowing in a very thin film or in a porous material, you always get a square root of time behavior for the spreading front. You get a diffusive dynamics. This is a very old result, and it happens all over, and it's very generic. In other words, the inputs into it are rather general, and so you always see it. So hopefully you'll take away one little quantitative idea from the first part of the talk, which involves spreading of liquids. And then in the second part of the talk, there's a little problem that comes up in fluid mechanics, where we refer to it as corner flows, and it comes up in electromagnetics. And I'll just point out an analogy that happens in a problem involving evaporation. Okay. So a common theme in what I'm talking about today is very thin films of liquid. In the engineering community, this is called lubrication because of when you want to lubricate machines. The term is used generically in fluid mechanics and physics, soft condensed matter systems, for any time you have thin liquid films. This is a field that comes up in many places, and so I'm an advocate of teaching it quite broadly, although it's not in most cases taught very much. And it's useful because it comes up in material science. It comes up in many different areas. whenever you have patterns, whenever you have thin films, maybe even if they're elastic, I'll show you examples of chemical heterogeneity and why it's useful in evaporation. And the two examples I give today are kind of areas where the lubrication idea is useful. Before I tell you those two examples, I'm going to give you one other example, just a comment, and I'll mention that now. So lubrication happens anytime you have film flow down a plane. Stephen Morris has been showing me wonderful examples of that. Anytime you coat a surface with any kind of material, a polymer, a film of any kind. Anytime you print small droplets on surfaces, you have thin films. So the idea is very generic. Now, here's another example of it. That it's work I've done with Adela Ben-Yakar. And when I first show this to you, I'm not going to try and explain exactly what we've done, but I'm going to show you a couple pictures. And first, you should be, you might be astonished that it's even a fluid mechanics problem. And then second of all, I'm going to suggest that the way we went about thinking about it was thinking about thin films of liquid. And the problem came up from a seminar I went to on laser micromachining, where people begin with a perfectly smooth glass surface. Then they take the glass surface and they shine on it one pulse of a laser that's on for 100 femtoseconds. Okay, so it's a little embarrassing to stand in front of a group of people and try and do math, but nano is 10 to the minus 9, pico is 12, femto is 10 to the minus 15. So the laser's on for 10 to the minus 13 seconds, and after one pulse of the laser, the smooth glass surface looks like this. It looks like a volcano. It has a width of about 5 microns, which happens to be the typical width of the laser beam. It has a depth of about 500 nanometers. It's essentially evacuated some material, and it has a rim height that's about 50 nanometers. Okay, so the argument that we've made for how the material rearranged after one pulse of the laser beam is the laser's on a very short time. It deposits an amount of energy into the surface. The surface melts and creates a thin liquid film. Whenever you do this kind of micromachining, you get a plasma above the surface at high pressure. The pressure pushes down on the liquid film and causes basically a tidal wave out, and then the whole thing solidifies within 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 6 seconds, and you get left with this. The 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 6 seconds is the thermal conductivity, the time set by thermal conduction through the solid. So here's a kind of funny example that people are working on in material science. And when I first saw it, after talking to the people for a while, we decided it was a fluid mechanics problem in disguise. And so we went about by thinking about thin liquid films. And for those of you who have met Adela, she's a great scientist in mechanical engineering at UT Austin. Okay, so that's just an example of how thin liquid films come up in unusual places. I'm going to tell you about two problems that have come up in my group, and they both involve, in different ways, surface tension. Okay, so surface tension classically is called capillary phenomena, and if you're looking for a kind of Newsweek-style discussion of capillary phenomena very broadly, you can read a beautiful article in Physics Today by Yves Pommeau and Emmanuel Fillermeau that's called 200 Years of Capillarity Research. Okay, and the article begins by saying, 2 centuries after seminal work by this man and this man, capillarities, modern applications arise in fields ranging from biology and oceanography to propulsion, material science, and novel devices. It's everywhere. Surface tension is everywhere. So before we go on a history quiz, who's the guy on the left and who's the guy on the right? Again? So one statement is the blind Belgian scientist plateau. That's not right. Nope. Plateau worked around the 1840s. This is 2 centuries, so the article was written in 2006 because in 1805, the person on the, I don't remember, I think it was the person on the right, and in 1806, the person on the left wrote 2 fundamental papers. Okay, so Young is on the right, and Laplace is on the left. Okay? Okay, so this is Laplace, and that's Thomas Young. You know Young, by the way, from Young diffraction. You also know him from Young's modulus and elasticity. He's also, there's a beautiful one-page piece in Nature if you want to read about a remarkable intellect. He also helped decipher one of the first Egyptian hieroglyphics. He is the person who coined the term Indo-European languages, and apparently this guy just worked all over the intellectual landscape, though not mathematically. So his paper essentially has no equations, but he argued the existence of surface tension and its physical manifestations, and then the mathematics were worked out by Laplace. Okay, so a little history. That's okay? All right. I was told to kind of keep this general, so so the first thing I'm going to try and tell you about is spreading of liquids where you lithographically pattern surfaces in very regular ways. Okay, so this is work done by a group of people who work in the Laurent Corbin as a postdoc. Etienne Daniel was visiting from Paris for a few months. Emily Dresser and Marcus Roper are graduate students at Harvard. And Arman Ashdari, who now works at Saint-Gobain Recherche, was visiting for the year. And basically, I'm going to show you how surfaces, when you place a liquid drop on them, cause polygonal-like shapes to the interface. Now, you might know that you can control where liquids spread on surfaces by using surface chemistry, like Teflon and surfaces. Okay. On the other hand, what I'm going to show you is that the surface is the same everywhere. If you put a small drop of liquid, you get the polygonal shape shown at the lower left. If you put a large drop of liquid, you get the identical shape, just spread more. And you can never do that with surface chemistry, because surface chemistry confines shape. So what I'll try and argue is how a shape is selected by the liquid, which means surface chemistry, in conjunction with surface topography. So if you've ever heard the term the lotus effect refers to liquids that don't like surfaces. And a classic example would be shown here. This is a liquid droplet sitting on a surface, basically a post, a pattern surface. I don't have a nice slide about this, but when you refer to the so-called contact angle, you measure the tangent to the surface by going through the liquid. So if you have a spherical drop, you would typically say I have a contact angle greater than 90 degrees. A typical nearly spherical drop on a surface, when you talk about hydrophobic surfaces, would have a contact angle of about 120 degrees, say. If you roughen the surface, you can get a nearly perfect spherical drop sitting on the surface. You can approach a contact angle of 180 degrees, and then you refer to surfaces that are so roughened as superhydrophobic, or in some papers, to emphasize superiority of the authors, they write ultrahydrophobic. This is an example where you would say that the original liquid had a contact angle of 120. You roughen the surface, you get 180. So you'd say that roughness enhances the characteristics of the surface, or roughness enhances the wetting, if you like. Roughness enhances the degree of non-wetting. Okay. This idea that roughness impacts how the shape of liquids on surfaces is a very old idea that goes back to the 1930s. It's been re-energized in the last 10 years in the material science and surface physics community because of the ability to lithographically pattern surfaces in very controlled ways. On the other hand, if you take a liquid that likes the surface, so you refer to it as a hydrophilic surface, the liquid can often do something like this. It can invade part of the roughness and sit on the surface with a contact angle that's lower than the equilibrium value. And then you refer to the idea that, yes, roughness enhances wetting. It makes the fluid wet a little and have a contact angle lower than its equilibrium value. And essentially what I'm going to tell you is that what people had mostly studied is the very hydrophilic case and the very hydrophobic case. And if you work in between the two, which is what we happen to do, you make some observations that hadn't been pointed out before. Now, just to recognize that surface chemistry gives you a degree of control, I'll just mention that work from Nick Abbott and the George Whitesides group showed a decade ago that if you just kind of pattern chemistry in different ways on a surface, you can confine droplets to non-circular shapes, polygonal shapes. That's just by using chemistry to keep the wetting from happening. There's an article in Science from a German group that basically just showed that many different ways you can lithographically pattern surfaces, you can confine liquids to those surfaces. And in some cases, if you have certain kinds of defects on the surface, chemical defects, you can trap the liquid in a fixed shape. This is a surface that has hexagonal defects on it. So everything I'm going to show you now involves both a given liquid, which means you have to tell me something about the surface chemistry, and it's impacted a lot by surface topography. And all but one or two slides I'm going to show you have a surface topography that looks like this. It's just a square array of posts, and all the dimensions in the problem are about 10 to 100 microns. So the posts have a spacing of 10 microns, a height 10 microns, and a radius or diameter about 10 to 100 microns. That's going to be true in every picture. And the liquid is going to sit generally above it and then try and invade this, if you like, this forest of posts. And the liquids we use have contact angles between about 0 and 30 degrees. You'd refer to them as hydrophilic, partially wetting liquids. We use both pure liquids and mixtures, and there's no real difference between them. Okay, and the experiment is very simple. You fabricate a substrate. We just use soft lithography to use PDMS substrates, and we just drop the liquid on the surface and then watch it with either still cameras for the final state or high-speed cameras for the dynamics. And a typical experiment goes like this. You can, in this picture, I'm going to show it twice. In the picture, I first want you to just look at how the wetting happens. You can see that there's this array of posts in the background, and when the liquid wets the surface, in this case, it adopts a square shape. And the feature of this shape, I'll point out right away that in order to kind of think through this, what we found it very useful to recognize is that, just like the floor, there's two lattice directions. They're essentially equivalent. But there's a distinguished direction, which is the diagonal. And that will be very important in thinking about the rate at which the liquid invades the substrate to form shapes. Now, if you play this again, I kind of showed you a slide on this together, but I personally was caught very much off guard by the intermediate shape. When I start this again, what you'll see right away is that the liquid droplet is sitting in the middle and is essentially a static reservoir that's feeding liquid that's running out in front of the droplet. And the dynamics, you can now see there's the reservoir of liquid. It's slowly supplying fluid, and the fluid is trying to spread out through the roughness, which is essentially a porous media. The intermediate state looks a little like this, and the time sequence from impact, where you essentially have a circular footprint, to final state is shown here. Everything happens on the order of a second or so. And basically, what happens is that the liquid tries to imbibe or spread. The lattice directions spread at the same rate, and what final shape you get, a little like the material science of roughened crystals, depends on how rapidly the diagonal moves relative to the lattice direction. Now, if you do this with other kinds of substrates, this is the one image, or at least the one movie I'm going to show you of a hexagonal substrate. I think you can see that if you have a substrate with hexagonal patterning, you can find states that end up with hexagonal shapes. So you can control the spread shape that way. Okay, now I have to make a point that whether or not this liquid, well, I should say it this way, whether or not this substrate gives you a square shape or a circular shape depends on the contact angle of the liquid. So if you change the contact angle of the liquid and put it on the surface, you might end up with a circle. In the experiment shown here, the contact angle is such you end up with a square. And the situation is such that for the same substrate, we found 7 different equilibrium shapes, 3 which are boring in the sense that the contact line gets stuck and can't move, and you end up with a pool of liquid trapped above the surface, either with a circular shape, in this case a shape, an 8-sided shape, or a square shape, and then 4 shapes where the liquid imbibes everywhere. If it imbibes such that the diagonals don't move very fast, you end up where the diagonals run very fast, you end up with a square shape. And if you change the liquid and change the contact angle, you can end up with shapes that essentially look circular by only changing the contact angle, going from left to right and making the fluid more and more wetting. Now, there's the way we've ended up having to think about this, we weren't quite sure how to think about it at all at first, is to just just recognize that there's interplay of two quantities. There's the contact angle called theta, here, theta equilibrium. And there's also the aspect ratio of the posts. So geometry enters the following way. If the contact angle is sufficiently small, the liquid can get from one post to another post because it wants to wet the surface, and then wetting happens all the time. In the same way, for the same contact angle, if you make the height large enough relative to the spacing between the posts, you can also get the liquid to the next post. And so there's an interplay between geometry, basically H over L, and theta equilibrium. And so we just generically refer to wettability as either the geometric parameter or the contact angle, because both of them take you from the left to the right in this picture. And we check that experimentally for the same liquid changing the geometry. Okay. The interpretation then goes like this. If you're familiar a little with roughening in material science, qualitative explanation is that the liquid tries to invade along the lattice axes. If it invades along the lattice axes, it has to go from one set of posts, which it likes to wet, to another set of posts, which it likes to wet, because they're partially wetting fluids. That occurs at a certain speed. On the other hand, if you look along the diagonal, what you notice is if you're a contact line, the distance from one post to another post is shorter along the diagonal than it is along the lattice axis because of the geometry of circles on this lattice. And so because it's a shorter distance from one post to another post, it's more favorable to run along the diagonal. So in this experiment, diagonal directions, liquid always runs along diagonal directions faster than it does along lattice directions. Okay, so qualitatively, that's very important for thinking about spreading in our problem. So whether you're a square or a circle depends on how fast diagonal directions run relative to square directions. And you can see it here. If in this picture the diagonal could run faster, you would fill out the diagonal and end up with a square. So geometrically, where you are in this picture depends on a ratio of two speeds, spreading on the diagonal versus spreading on the lattice direction. Now, the dynamics of imbibition go like this. You first wet a single post. It likes to do that. And then you slowly invade parallel to it to try and make the contact line straight. We refer to this either as zipping or unzipping, depending on the time of day we're looking at it. But there's a fast step followed by a slow step. And then this sequentially happens all along as you move. Now, if you're familiar with fluid mechanics and condensed matter physics, you know that in the 80s and 90s, there was an enormous amount of work done on flow and porous media, what's called Healy-Shaw flow. And at some point, the people doing that started to study imbibition or invasion of pattern porous media. And you'll find, actually, in the pattern porous media literature, at least one paper by Leonard Armand, where he had pointed out that in many pattern porous media, you see this kind of stepwise picture. And consequently, although we're putting drops on a surface and talking about spreading, in fact, the liquid is just invading the rough in front, just like liquid invades any porous media. Okay. So here's, if you're interested in a little fluid mechanical fact that goes back to the early parts of the 1900s, I'll now just point out to you a very generic fact about viscous fluids. I have to be a little careful about this, but I'll say you can find papers in the literature, including the physics literature and the fluid mechanics literature, where people somehow haven't realized this. But in many areas this is known, and that is anytime you invade a porous media, our porous media being the porous media of posts, where there's a typical scale at which friction acts, which is the center-to-center distance between the posts, the invasion, the distance over which the spreading happens grows as the square root of time, and you'd refer to that as diffusive dynamics. And that's generic for surface tension driven for many problems. And I realize I had forgotten one thing here. So now what I'm just going to point out, I don't know if you can see this, but you have a drop on the surface, you have a front, and there's a distance between the reservoir of liquid and the front. That distance, in the next slide I'm going to call L. If you now try and ask why spreading happens, it happens because of capillarity. So the interface, which has a certain surface tension, is curved on a certain scale, which is geometric and set by the posts. That pressure difference causes a fluid motion. The fluid motion involves the friction, the viscosity, and a frictional scale, and it also depends on the distance over which the fluid is moved between the reservoir and the front. If you simply balance the capillary pressure and the viscous driving force and identify V as L divided by T, you always end up with L growing as square root of time, and a, quote, diffusivity can be simply identified from the equation. Because these two little facts are so, if you like, simple, they apply to many, many problems, and they kind of happen over and over again in viscous fluid problems. And so we simply measured the rate of imbibition on the lattice axis and the rate of imbibition on the diagonal. The blue is along the lattice direction. The red is along the diagonal. They both roughly grow as the Washburn result, square root of time over long times. And the diagonal always goes faster than the lattice direction. And so this is consistent, if you like, with everything you might think about for flow and porous media. And now, how much faster the diagonal is than the lattice simply sets the shape. And so qualitatively, we argue that what shape you see in the four that invade the fluid simply depends on how much faster the diagonals move than the lattice directions. And in the special case that the diagonal starts to move roughly the square root of two faster than the lattice direction, you can support eight-sided figures on a square lattice. And if the diagonal doesn't move fast enough that the lattice direction is moving almost as fast as the lattice direction, you start to produce essentially circular shapes. So the qualitative picture we have, which is consistent with the so-called Washburn result, is simply a picture of comparing two timescales. And this roughly now tries to explain why we see what we see, and it involves both parameters. It involves the topography, basically something about the geometry, and something about the contact angle. Okay. We don't really have any more detailed theory for it than that, but we spent some time thinking about, will this ever be useful, the fact that you can pattern surfaces and control where liquid goes and make shapes. So if anyone has ideas, share them. But I'll just tell you a few that we've been thinking about. You know, the boring things are, I showed you that you can control shape from squares to circles, and that, you know, obviously you can control color, but that's kind of boring for the same surface. On the other hand, I did point out right at the beginning that chemistry can't do this. If you put a small droplet on the surface, if it has the right contact angle, it's a square. If you put a large amount of fluid, you get a bigger square. The same is true for hexagonal shape. So you can control size of an imprinted pattern. But now you can start to mix them a little. So if you take a square lattice and stretch it, you get a rectangular lattice. And if you combine square or rectangular lattices with hexagonal lattices, you can create features. So, for example, if you stretch the square lattice, these are elastic substrates, you can take the same thing and make it rectangular shapes. And if you can combine a rectangle and a triangle, anybody know what you might get? So if you take the surface and make a rectangular lattice on the right and a hexagonal lattice on the left and supply the fluid at the boundary, you get an arrow. And the size of the arrow only depends on how much fluid you put down. So we've been trying to explore, you know, other ways that we can manipulate fluids. Okay, so that's the first story about polygonal spreading. But what it did then start to get us thinking about are pattern substrates and impact of the substrate on other fluid mechanical problems. And so we observed that, at some point my group, for reasons I don't understand, they all got interested in splashing and how splashing happens and things like that. And so they started to splash liquids on surfaces. And so we did splashing on surfaces that have a pattern. Now, if you splash on a smooth surface, if you drop a drop of liquid on a smooth surface, you get a splash, at least if the impact velocity is sufficiently high. So I'm going to show you two more pictures where everything is identical, impact speed, fluid, drop height, all of those things, except for the surface. And as you add a small amount of roughness to the surface, you decrease the intensity of the splash. And if you make this post pattern, the spacing of the posts a little closer, you can turn off the splash, everything else being the same. Now, there must be some limit in this, because if you put them sufficiently close together, you have a smooth surface again, and then you get the splash. But this just points out, and this was work done by my postdoc, Laurent Corbon, 2 years ago, that the role of the roughness can have an impact on the dynamics of a splash. And in the fluid mechanics and physics world, there, as far as I know, there is no theory for really splashing or predicting the, either the drop size or how you get a splash. There are some conjectures, and there are lots of now observations. Because we were interested in the substrate, we made the substrate soft, so we basically started to make flexible substrates. And if the substrate is a flexible substrate, this is just a thin film of plastic saran wrap. If it has a sufficiently high tension, you get a splash. And as you systematically reduce the tension, you take momentum out of the system and you can turn off the splash using elasticity of the substrate. So we've been looking a little bit about how changing physical parameters allow you to systematically influence the impact. Finally, I'm going to show you one other thing where a pattern impacts a hydrodynamic problem. This is something called a hydraulic jump. How many of you have heard of a hydraulic jump? You see this in your kitchen all the time. If you have a jet of water coming down, it impacts the surface, it runs out in a thin film, and then some distance away from the impact, it jumps up to a thicker film, and that's called the hydraulic jump. And here you see, this is just water impacting a surface, and you see the typical radius of the hydraulic jump is, you know, some 10 radii of the jet diameter. Okay. So as this slide gives away, I'm going to tell you about polygonal hydraulic jumps, and I'll just point out that there are two groups that have found hydraulic jumps that are not circles but polygons. As far as I can tell, they only found unstable polygons. In other words, if they disturbed it, it changed to something else. One group was Thomas Bohr in Denmark, and the other group was John Bush at MIT. And they both found it by making the fluid very viscous, and I'm not sure how well they understand it, but they found polygons. That's weird a little if you think about surface tension, and they were unstable. So what I'm going to show you is a polygonal hydraulic jump with water. And so this is water impacting a circular piece of material that has the surface topography I've already shown you, a square lattice. And when the fluid impacts the surface, it starts with a hydraulic jump at low speeds that looks like a circle. But when it impacts the pattern and you increase the speed, you get a polygon. And the polygon exists outside the substrate. Okay, so I'm not sure how much I should give away, but I think this is an area of fluid mechanics and surface physics that's completely unstudied in the sense that there's a thin film, it's flowing over a surface that has a pattern below it, but it knows about the pattern because it recognizes the variation of friction, if you like, between the lattice directions and the diagonal direction, and it even exists, if you like, with some memory outside the region of the pattern. And so this is something we're working on now. We kind of can correlate what we see, and it's just another area where patterning impacts a hydrodynamic phenomena. Okay, so that's everything about the first part of the talk that involves kind of liquids, patterns, pattern substrates, and spreading of different kinds. Okay? I've got 20 minutes? 15? Faster, 10? How much do I have? Okay. I'm getting different votes, so we'll see. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to tell you is another problem that involves a film. This happened I don't quite remember how it happened, but Carmen Dominguez, she was working in my lab for the summer. She was a Harvard undergraduate, and she was working with a couple of my postdocs, Bill Rissenpart and Jiandi Wan. We eventually got help from another Harvard undergraduate, Peter Kim, and they were looking at how liquids evaporate on substrates, and there was just something odd that happened about it that I'm now going to try and explain. And if those of you who know Charlie Ward's work probably will say that, Charlie knew all this, I think. And if you know what Charlie's doing, then you'll quickly see what I'm going to tell you. But my understanding is what I'm telling you wasn't quite in the literature. Okay. So an interlude, though. I'm going to tell you a little about surface tension and fluid motions driven by tangential variations of surface tension. And this is called the Marangoni phenomena in fluid mechanics. And it happens whenever you place wine in a glass and swirl it. This is looking at a little petri dish from above. The wine is down below. You can see thin films of liquid up here, and there are these rivulets of liquid falling down. Those are called wine tears. I think most of you have probably, you certainly observed them. You might have, if you don't, if you're a hard alcohol person, you've observed more of them, at least for part of the evening. Sometimes they're called legs in a glass of wine, and they're extremely, an amazing phenomenon. If you look near the bottom of the, where the wine tear connects with the bath of fluid, you can even see a large set of instabilities transverse to the normal direction of the wine tears. So they're really quite remarkable. So you can ask a couple physical questions. Why do they form? And then you can ask who first described them. Okay, so why do they form is not so hard. If you have alcohol and water in a container and you swirl it and get a thin film, what you recognize is that the alcohol primarily evaporates from the thin film, and that the surface tension of a dirty system is lower than a surface tension of a clean system. So since you're primarily water at the top, you have a high surface tension, and you have water and alcohol at the bottom, you have a low surface tension, and so the liquid gets dragged up the surface by a force that's called a Marangoni stress. And that eventually leads to gravitational instability, that's the tears in a glass of wine. Okay, so you're allowed to ask some questions. Actually, do you mind a little history? You're allowed to ask who was Marangoni, and did he observe it first? Okay, so Eugenia's shaking her head. I guess not, she doesn't believe in Marangoni, but she doesn't believe he observed it first. Marangoni was an obscure 19th century Italian physicist, and I believe this is the only picture of Marangoni. Now, I should say where I got this. I went to a number of conferences over the years that always had a special section on Marangoni phenomena. It's an area of physics and fluid mechanics. And at some point when, you know, there were no questions, I started to ask the speaker, who was Marangoni? And the first speaker at a conference I asked said he didn't know. The second speaker got mad at me. The third speaker told me to shut up. But there was a man in the audience named Raphael Savino who worked in Italy who I talked to, and he went back and he contacted someone at the institute that Marangoni worked at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, and she sent him this photograph. Now, I admit that this could be her or Savino's grandfather. I don't know, but they claim this is Marangoni. Okay, so did he observe it first? And the answer to that is no. About 10 years before Marangoni, the phenomena was first described by an English scientist named James Thomson, who I think was trained in engineering, and he wrote a paper with a beautiful title on certain curious motions observable at the surfaces of wine and other alcoholic liqueurs. So who is James Thomson? Okay, so there's someone in the audience who knows the story. So James Thomson was the older brother of William Thomson, and William Thomson is better known as Lord Kelvin. So for those of you who don't know, you are allowed to ask the question, if his real name was William Thomson, where did Kelvin come from? Okay, now, unlike Rayleigh, Lord Rayleigh, that was the family name he was born into. Thomson was made a lord by the queen does this and you get to become a lord. And so he chose the name that's now our temperature scale, and someone might know the answer to this. He chose his name from the river that ran outside his house by Glasgow University that happens to be called the Kelvin. So the origin of our temperature scale is that. Okay, all right, so what does this have to do with small droplets of liquid? The group at Chicago led by Sid Nagel have pointed out that the common coffee stain is a phenomena of evaporation. This is the top view of a liquid drop of coffee that's evaporated, and the coffee particles or colloidal particles end up all collected at the rim, so you see a black stain. This is work done by Robert Deegan working with Sid's group. And the typical explanation given for why, in general, for coffee, the particles all end up at the edge is that if you ask about the evaporation rate for liquids that wet part of a surface but not the rest of a surface, the evaporation rate is higher at the edge. So the liquid gets carried to the edge. They carry the particles with it, and all the particles get deposited at the contact line, and you end up with a collection of particles. And they visualize the motion of the particles all collecting at the contact line. And so that is the origin, they would argue, of any colloidal stain or the coffee stain. Now, this is one area that's been well studied in recent years. Robert Deegan, in fact, pointed out that the energy for evaporation comes from the liquid. That means there's a temperature change in the liquid. If there's a temperature change in the liquid, there's a surface tension variation in the liquid. And so they suggested that if there was a surface tension-driven flow, here's a picture from their paper. They said, well, it's a liquid sitting on a surface. They argued, if you don't like this, just be patient for a second. They argued it should be coldest at the top, warmest at the bottom. If it's coldest at the top, the surface tension is highest at the top. So they drew arrows going from your left to your right, and they drew a circulation pattern just like this. Now, this problem has been revisited by a number of groups. Ron Larson's group at the University of Michigan has done written four papers on the subject with extensive numerics, and almost all their simulations show this feature, the same circulation pattern as Deegan sketched. Does the suggestion that it's coldest at the top bother you? If I showed you this evaporation rate with the evaporation highest at the edge, what might you think? Why isn't it cold at the edge? Is that right? So this is a little backwards the way we came on this, but for the life of me, I could not understand how, if the evaporation rate was highest at the edge, how you couldn't have situations where it would be coldest at the edge. And if it was coldest at the edge, the surface tension would be highest at the edge. If the surface tension would be highest at the edge, it should be circulating the other direction. And I basically lost a lot of sleep one summer trying to understand how the numerics could ever be right. The numerics are right, but the numerics have an assumption, and an assumption in every paper, well, every paper that we know in the literature is that this is the case so long as the substrate is isothermal, or constant temperature. And so we started to realize at some point that whether or not you got the circulation pattern might depend on the conductivity of the substrate, which was a variable that had been left out of almost every calculation we know. So the short story I'm going to tell you about is, how do you think about flow in a corner when you have evaporation and you account for the effect of the substrate? Okay, I'll just point out that the Chicago group, as far as I can tell, didn't do one thing. And so I'll just tell you one little story. If you ask, these are small spherical particles, they're running into a corner where there's a contact line, how do they pack? And as far as I can tell, the Chicago group, who were a set of wonderful experimentalists, didn't put it under the microscope, right? So my group, for different reasons, was looking at this problem. We had an undergraduate working with this named Janine Nunes. We saw a certain pattern formation, but we looked in the neighborhood of a contact line where evaporation happened. And because the contact line is always a wedge or a corner, you can take nanometer-sized particles and actually see that they're perfectly stacked, going from one particle thick to two particles thick to three particles thick in the neighborhood of a contact line. And in fact, I believe in any evaporating system that's evaporated slow enough, you get essentially perfect colloidal packing, and this is fundamental to areas that many colloid scientists work on in colloidal crystals, because the evaporation can cause very regular ordering of colloidal objects. Okay, but the story I'm going to tell you is one of the circulation. I just want to argue a little about the circulation. And so in the last 5 minutes, I'm just going to sketch the idea of what's the flow, what's the circulation pattern inside a droplet. We got interested in this at some point because we thought controlling the circulation pattern might allow us to say something about deposits on a surface, and maybe you don't always have deposits at contact lines. For this part of the talk, the contact line angle is alpha, and if you have a drop that's small enough, it's a section of a sphere, so we impose a shape, the height, it's not labeled here, the height, which is just a section of a sphere where R is the radius measured outward from the middle. And there's a mass flux off the surface sketched here, which is like an electromagnetics problem. It has a square root singularity near the edge, which is modified slightly by the contact angle, and we just treat the evaporation rate as a given function. Now, the way the majority of people study this problem is they ignore convection, and Charlie Ward and Koshuk, one of his postdocs, and others are questioning this. I won't debate this. I'll just say if you ignore the advection effect, you just treat the thermal problem as conduction. Conduction in a narrow region is lubrication, so you just keep vertical derivatives. And if you take that statement and combine it with two boundary conditions, a temperature specified at the substrate and a conservation law for evaporation where delta H is an enthalpy of evaporation, you're forced to the conclusion that the drop is always coldest at the top. And that's simply because you've forced the idea of an isothermal substrate. And as soon as you force the idea of an isothermal substrate and impose evaporation at the surface, the drop is coldest along the longest length through the droplet, which is the top. As soon as it's coldest at the top, you're forced to the conclusion that the circulation goes from the middle to the edge and back up the surface. You have no caveat in that. And so we relaxed the assumption on the isothermal condition. And if you make that statement, you can actually do everything analytically. And in the interest of time, I'll skip it. I'll just say this. If you have a corner, so the corner shown here, with liquid of a certain conductivity, and it's connected to a semi-infinite substrate of a different conductivity, the local problem, which involves solving the Laplace equation, can all be done analytically simply because there's no length scale. And so because there's no length scale, you're forced to conclude that any temperature profile only depends on distance, which you normally call R, measured from the corner. And then you can determine everything analytically as far as imposing all the boundary conditions of evaporation, temperature and energy conservation at the substrate, and temperature and energy conservation off the substrate. And so you can determine everything analytically for this problem. And once you know everything analytically, you know the temperature profile. If you know the temperature profile, I claim you know the surface tension variations. If you know surface tension variations, you know what flow is. So we worked all that out, and there are two results. One is, if the substrate has a high conductivity, the isotherms are nearly parallel to the substrate. If the isotherms are narrowly parallel to the substrate, the drop is coldest at the top, and that's the stress I already sketched for you. The drop goes from the circulation is as the laser is doing. On the other hand, if you solve this problem and allow for conductivity through the substrate, in other words, you allow for heat flux through this system, then the drop is now taking the heat flux reduces the temperature in the corner. I think that's many people's intuitions. It was certainly Stephen's intuition this morning. The drop's coldest at the corner. The surface tension's largest at the corner. The stress is towards the corner. And the circulation pattern is as I'm sketching. And that's opposite what was sketched in the literature. But it's a substrate effect. Okay. So we did experiments on this. And everything can be collapsed to two parameters. What is the liquid? So what is the contact angle? And what is the ratio between the solid to liquid conductivity ratio? We have a little theory that comes from the small calculation I said that demarcates this curve, which demarcates what I'll call, you know, the Chicago circulation pattern, the regular circulation pattern calculated by Ron Larson and company, and the opposite one that I'm showing at the bottom here. The triangles are numerical work from Ron Larson and company. It turned out they had two data points they didn't comment on where the circulation pattern was reversed, and five, which it went the normal way, and it roughly agrees with the theory. And we've done experiments with four different liquids, methanol, isopropyl alcohol, and a couple others, and the two at the top have the circulation pattern at the top, and the two at the bottom have the circulation pattern at the bottom. And to emphasize this change in the circulation pattern, I'll just show you the following movie, and then I'll stop. The movie we're looking from below, and the objective is focused at the bottom. So anything in focus is near the bottom, and anything out of focus is above it. So just follow particles. The gray are out of focus, and the black are in focus. Oops. That's my new laptop. Here it is. Okay, so out of focus is going outward. Black, you can follow anything, it'll come in focus, it comes in focus, it moves inward. And so that's the opposite pattern that I showed you at the beginning. That's things moving inward along the bottom and outward along the top. And so that's the profile associated with the heat flux near the corner dominating everything. So that's, I'm sorry about that. That's this picture where the stress is towards the corner causing the circulation pattern. Okay, so that's I think that's essentially my talk. I'll just close here. This is what I tried to show you, besides the little bits of history and the two little pieces of mathematics about Washburn and corners. I told you about spreading on liquids and just showed you how surface chemistry and surface roughness can lead to polygonal structures. And this evaporation problem just points out, in our view, that the role of the substrate can be important in emphasizing some fluid mechanics, and we've been trying to understand in what ways it might be playing a role in deposition. That's it. So thank you for your attention. Okay, so
what modifications do you have to make to coffee without the stain?
So in this case, what is true is whether or not a surface stains is a more complicated problem than I hinted at. You can certainly get deposition patterns that have a lot more particles towards the middle, including some that look more uniform. That's a much more complicated problem because it starts to depend on the contact line and whether or not the contact line stays pinned, and also how the particle interacts with the substrate. And we haven't exactly sorted it out, but we do know that changing the liquid for a given substrate can change the deposition pattern. The coffee stain on the tablecloth, though, raises this issue. Shortly after doing this work, I did cause a coffee stain on my shirt. And that's a problem that involves colloids first being transported in porous media, your shirt, and then evaporation. And we actually had a student last summer that spent the summer working on it. It turns out I can't find very much literature on it, but whether or not the kind of pattern you see, the stain pattern you see, depends on both the porosity of the substrate, because that sets how the particles are initially distributed. Then evaporation always tries to run them towards the corner, because the evaporation rate is higher near the edge. And there are also some physical chemistry matters, how the particles interact with the fiber substrate. So there are actually some problems there that are, you know, in this classical area of objects and porous media and coupling all this together. But it's hard for me to say anything more quantitative. So I gave a long answer. The short answer was no, I don't know how to do that. No, that's not true. What is true about stains, right, is you know that putting salt on stains is known to help, and that's believed, I think, to be that it breaks the interaction between the particle and the fiber and then makes it easier to clean. So there are issues about just surface chemistry. It's, you know, the detergent problem is partly that one. So the old wives' tale about salt, I think, is relevant to cleaning it, but that's afterwards. So the question is, can you choose a conductivity ratio so that there's no temperature gradient along the interface? And I think the answer to that is no. There's always a temperature gradient along the interface. Oh, you're going to say, let's see, yeah, right. So you're going to say that for a given contact angle, can I find a conductivity ratio where it stops?
There is no rotation. It changes from right to...
Well, I guess that's that curve I sketch. So I guess that's the curve I sketch, yeah.
And then you wouldn't have rotation, maybe...
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if you're allowed freedom in this, I guess you're going to say, yeah, there might be some where it doesn't do one or the other. There's one thing. All I told you about is what Marangoni flows do. You always have the fact that evaporation is highest at the edge is always carrying flow out towards the corner, and that you have to add to the Marangoni problem I had. So you always have that effect. The issue with the contact line is, does the contact line stay pinned? If the observation is, if enough particles get to the contact line soon enough, that tends to pin the contact line. Then all the particles collect there as the drop loses its volume. What you see if not enough particles get to the contact line early enough, it can systematically depin. But there's always that evaporation effect on top of what I said, which is the Marangoni effect. Well, so the question is, if you tilt the surface, what happens? We did try one. I don't know if this is quite what you mean. Gravity doesn't really play a role. So the only role here first is the drops are small enough that gravity doesn't matter too much, but capillarity does. So we haven't specifically tried it, but I would have thought that for small enough drops, it's still all wetting and gravity doesn't play much of a role. On the other hand, the experiment we did do is we did try and roll drops down the surface that were patterned, and we were curious whether or not they might kind of veer to one side or the other because of a change in hydrodynamic mobility, but nothing really happened with that. We didn't really explore it more than an afternoon, though. I guess that was what you were thinking. Yeah, for big drops, for surface tension problems, there's always a length scale, which is the interplay of surface tension and gravity, which is called the capillary scale. And above that length scale, gravity tends to matter a lot. So the size of the raindrop, if you ask, what sets the typical size of a raindrop? It's typically about a millimeter, because that's the capillary length for water. Square root of surface tension divided by rho g. So liquids on surfaces all have this feature that above that length scale, gravity tends to matter, so things tend to be flattened by gravity. And below that length scale, surface tension matters, so you try and be a sphere because that minimizes the surface area. And that's a just generic feature of the interplay of the two. No one's ever said, and he's seen anything I've done and said amazing, so I really feel flattered. Yeah, we haven't measured it precisely, but we think it's a few hundred microns, so it's above the posts.
And I would guess that all the flows across the surface, no matter if it's a little post or not, basically have non-slip boundaries.
Right.
There. So what the heck is going on?
Right. Okay. Okay. So the ordinary thing you would have said for flow over a surface, and I would have said the same thing you did, that the generic hydrodynamic statement is that flow over rough surfaces far away from the surface looks effectively like a no-slip condition. So all I can say is that doesn't quite fit here, right? And that there must be something different when you have a thin film flow flowing over the surface. And what is true is if you take the theory for the hydraulic jump, which is part a high Reynolds number flow theory and part kind of an ad hoc description of the rim, including viscosity, and this was done in the 60s by Watson. He has a theory for what the radius is as a function of all the parameters in the problem. If you take that theory and where the viscosity is, simply make the statement that viscosity represents friction with a substrate, and now the substrate just has a different friction. The two axes look different than the diagonal in the way I sketched before, and just put in a functional form, you roughly fit what we see. Now, I think what that's saying is that for a thin film flow over substrate, and this is why I think this is an area of hydrodynamics that hasn't been studied and is industrially relevant because you're often putting thin films on patterned surfaces, that is, your statement probably on the scale, as long as you're on the scale of the post, you are seeing some remnant anisotropy between the lattice directions and the other direction, the diagonal, and that isotropy, though small, is important in dynamical phenomena. No. We think it's a few hundred microns in the neighborhood. If you do, yeah. I don't think it's millimeter scale, no. Where it jumps up, it's much thicker, but yeah. Okay, so, right. So for most, so the question is how does droplet momentum affect the shape? So there are two things that I showed you. One, splashing. And two, this slow spreading. For the slow spreading, the speeds are such that the Reynolds number is low and momentum doesn't matter. For splashing phenomena, momentum is important. It's a high Reynolds number flow phenomena. You're hitting it meters per second and you're changing the momentum of the fluid by causing it to slow down vertically and spread horizontally. Yeah. Well, so the problem I showed you on the spreading into the lattice, we gently have the drop on the surface, then capillarity pulls it through right? And if you calculate a Reynolds number for that, it's just not very big. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's normally less than one. And when a Reynolds number is less than one, that's a ratio of inertia to viscosity. You don't have to worry about inertia at all. For the impact problem, the splash problem, it's a high Reynolds number flow problem. The Reynolds numbers are order 100, and I think it's fair to say that when the Reynolds number is on the order of 1 to 10, it's very difficult to do anything analytically with the Navier-Stokes equations. And so what's in the splashing literature are mostly order of magnitude estimates for explaining what you see. If you had ideas on this, I'm open to them, because it's we have lots of now observations, and so do many other groups on this kind of phenomena of impact, where it's clearly an inertial phenomena. Yeah, that'd be great. So can you explain it? My impression of the work at this stage is that there's certainly simulations one can do to provide insight. But trying to organize all the information in terms of Reynolds number, Weber number, and in this case roughness parameters, they're ad hoc formulas like the square root of Reynolds number times the quarter power of Weber number is greater than 50. No one can explain 50, and 50 depends on roughness, but it correlates experimental data. But maybe there's more known than that. Yeah. So you're going to say, if you have a formula, r to the n is x to the n plus y to the n, what determines n?
No, I'm saying that.
Your formula won't. Wait a second. Your formula isn't quite this shape, right? Because that formula for bigger n is nearly straight sides with a smooth surface, where this is really faceted. So your formula has certain features that are right, but
exactly. So at what point does it transit to a faceted polygonal shape? At what sort of n have you estimated that?
But your formula will never have a facet with any n.
No, it won't. And that's the point. At some point, it breaks down. That formula just would not hold anymore. I was wondering if you.
Yeah, I guess I. No, I don't know. I'd be happy to talk about it. The way we've thought about it is in terms of these relative speeds of imbibition. Now, you can make a more quantitative statement than the one I made, because effectively, anytime you invade a porous media, one thing you can ask in this case, because it's regular porous media, is the number of posts per unit length set the resistance, and that's different along the lattice axis and along the diagonal. So I can make a somewhat quantitative statement about how resistance varies with orientation, and maybe that's towards the answer you want, but I don't quite know what more to do at this point.